Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to the Future Proof podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be speaking to a renowned authority on military secrets and US defence policy, Annie Jacobson, who's going to be telling us about her extremely well-researched book on a hypothetical scenario. What would happen if somebody launches a nuclear missile at the United States? The answer is the end of the world. If you want to make sure that you've given yourself enough time in your schedule to listen to this in its entirety, I recommend you do that. Find yourself a dark hole somewhere, put yourself in it, and listen to this podcast because it will blow your mind. It's both fascinating and terrifying in equal measure. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the week's news stories, and we're joined in studio by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. Our first story, Shane, has to do with something that particle physicists are very excited about, but I don't understand at all.
Yes.
You have a short amount of time to explain what the hell's going on.
It's probably going to take me all the time just to say the title of the effect that was observed. It's called the Fractional Quantum Anomalous Hall Effect, right? And it was done in MIT. And effectively what they've shown is that electrons can become fractions of themselves, right? Which completely does not make sense to most physicists. They think of an electron as an indivisible particle. But they've shown that you can actually see them in fractions. So it's to do with nanomaterials. And nanomaterials are materials that have one or more dimensions that are atomic scale. And that allows you to tap into their incredible properties. So the Hall effect in general is something we've known about for a long time. It basically says if you get a magnetic field and you it pushes against a conducting metal wire, that you get this thing called a Hall voltage set up within it, which is effectively like a force, a pushing force that's perpendicular to the flow of electrons through a wire. And you'd be thinking, what the hell has that got to do with anything, right? That's how majority of joysticks work. So in terms of being able to push and pull things and it translates into something on screen. You can also, if you shrink the materials to nano size, do something called the quantum Hall effect, which is where the material becomes so small that the effect becomes quantized. That is, it doesn't just kind of ramp up and ramp down, but instead it goes in steps. That's where quantum comes from, things that you can actually quantify and count. And then you add in the next bit, which is the fractional bit. And this really is amazing. The 1998 Nobel Prize went for this effect alone, where they showed that the steps of this change could be fractions of the electron's charge. And again, to a physicist, that really is bamboozling, because we wouldn't have thought that the electron could be chopped up in terms of its nature. Enter the final piece of the jigsaw here, which is the anomalous bit. What they found here is that you can build a material out of graphene, which is a single layer of honeycombed carbon. You put five of those together and you cap them with something called boron nitride and you twist them. And that twisting effect actually sets up a kind of a tension within the material that behaves like a magnetic field. And so when you add all these incredibly complex things together, you can build a material that shows this fractional quantum anomalous Hall effect. And you're all thinking, why would anyone care? Well, beyond the fact that we can push the limits of physics, what you can do here is you can start to build the components for a quantum computer. And so that's what all these things are probably going to be used for, is building the new technologies that will power quantum computers and the technology that we'll have for the 21st century.
Does this have anything to do with superpositions?
No.
Okay. Great. We'll leave that out then. I'm going to not ask you a question on that and move on to the second story.
Good.
To save any embarrassment. Ruth, our second story has to do with sleep.
With sleep and how not sleeping very well can make you feel much older. And this might not be a big surprise to people, but this is sort of a study looking at how you feel when you've had a good night's rest, or maybe you've had a really bad night's rest, in terms of your age. And it's from researchers in Sweden. It's been published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And what they did two different studies. So for the first one, they looked back over a month's sleep and they had a group of over 400 people ranging in age from 18 to 70. And they got them to answer questions about how well they had slept during the past month. And they used some scales to assess how sleepy they felt. And what they found, that for every day of poor sleep somebody reported, on average, they felt 3 months older. But those who had good sleep for the whole month reported feeling, on average, nearly 6 years younger than their actual age. Now, again, you can imagine there's plenty of degrees of freedom in that study, how people remember things and how they felt on the day that they were asked. But they did follow up with another study, a smaller group, just under 200 people. And here they had a more controlled environment. People had two really good nights rest where they slept for more than 9 hours. And then it was followed up by two nights where they only got 4 hours sleep. So they were prevented from sleeping any longer. And this is kind of the headline outcome, because just after those two nights of bad sleep, people felt 4.4 years older than their real age. Whereas actually when they've had good sleep, they did feel a little bit younger. But what they're saying is really that intervention of good sleep has such a huge impact. It's one of the best things you can do is get a couple of good nights sleep. And one of the worst things you can do for yourself is have bad sleep. Because once you feel older, you're also probably less likely to exercise. It's going to impact on your mental well-being. So they're really, I mean, not that it's breaking news, but sleep is really important. And even only after a couple of days, you're going to feel the impacts of poor sleep.
I don't know how I'd answer that. I kind of feel like I'm 12. I've always felt like I'm 12. I've never felt any older. I always feel like a child. I snigger at double entendres. The first thing that comes to my head is always something completely inappropriate, and I have to like push that boy to the back and then pretend to imagine what an adult would feel like. Feel 41 or feel 52.
But I think it was more about how your body felt, you know, how they felt
physically.
How
on earth do you age that?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a study that's challenging to interpret in an absolute way.
Right. What I'm saying is a fraction of 4 years. Like, for me, I remember how I felt at 40, which was much faster and so on. Like, a year or two or like 3 months older. Like, it's odd for me to parse this information.
Also, telling people you need more sleep if they are chronically, you know, deprived of sleep, perhaps for good reasons, only going to make them feel worse.
Well, exactly. And I think the thing is, like, people have different kind of clocks. You know, some people, there are morning people and evening people. And, you know, some people feel differently depending on, some people cope much better with going to bed late. Some people cope very poorly with that. And they did pick that out as well. But certainly, like, when we look at sleep, we know it's important. I think this is sort of telling us that again. Mm. So now we know more.
Okay. Our third story, Shane, is an interesting one. It's to do with dogs.
Yes, and that the fact that they can understand the meaning of nouns, which is incredible, right? So we know they can understand commands like, well, most dogs can. Sit, walkies, lie down, fetch, these sorts of things.
My dog will not fetch, but everything else, yes.
There's hope, right?
Not with this dog.
They, they can also, though, understand nouns, so like ball, lead, etc., things like that, right? But what this study has shown is that they're really able to do more than just kind of recall. The paper suggests they have an actual understanding of what the word means, right? Which is remarkable. It's from people in Hungary, in the Lorand University. We've mentioned these before, but they've done a lot of work on understanding dogs. They cited a paper from 2011 where intensive training on a border collie resulted in the collie being able to understand the names for 1,000 objects, right? I think it's more interesting perhaps to understand why a human would have taught the collie 1,000 objects, but that's for another study. What they did here was they got dogs and they put EEG caps on them, so little helmets, right? Yeah. They're able to understand or to measure brain signals. And their owners picked up words that the dogs knew, so like ball, right? And the owner could do one of two things. They could either be truthful with the dog and show them a ball, or they could show them something that was like, you know, not a ball, like a lead. And they measured the dog's brain signals for both scenarios. And they saw that there was a significant difference. They repeated the study with humans and they saw the exact same sort of difference. So they're inferring here that the dog realizes that's not the word that corresponds to that object. And that's the height of this study. But it is very interesting to think that dogs are actually able to physically understand the meaning of these words. What they do say, though, is the dog may not be able to understand the concept of ball. They might just know that's my ball and I'm not interested in any other balls, or I wouldn't know that anything that looks like that might be called.
It's a proper
ball.
Noun. It's exactly. A capital B. If I say to the dog ball, I mean, any dog other than my dog, I feel bad actually giving a head about my dog. She's a great dog.
But, you should be loyal to your dog.
Yeah. Well, she's loyal to me. That's the point. No, but if I say to her, ball. She'll go to the ball. She doesn't bring it back is the only problem. But she'll know that's the ball. Did we not know that dogs knew nouns? I can't understand what the difference is. This is just me.
Perhaps so. Yeah, I think it's showing a little bit more that they, you know, it would have been perhaps that we wouldn't have understood the full connotation. It might have been, is it just the scenario that they know or do they know the word? So
right,
you get ready to go for a walk. Do they understand the word walk or do they understand that you're putting your shoes on and you're in a routine?
That's it, because the sort of joke was always that you could say anything to a dog and say it like you're saying walkies and the dog would get really excited.
Exactly.
But the dog might be realizing that you're saying something completely different.
Again,
and still
you
going,
should be kinder to your dog.
I'm very nice to my dog. My dog is great. Our final story, Ruth, has to do with this amazing, what we thought was a myth about the Amazon warriors of Greece.
Yeah, so the Amazons, sort of these famous women warriors who rode around on horseback, famous for their archery skills. You know, even in some legend, they removed one of their breasts so they could more easily fire arrows and that nothing would get in the way in the front. And this is a story of a new excavation that's happening in Azerbaijan. And it looks like a grave that's about 4,000 years old. And these are women who have been buried in the grave. And they are surrounded, I suppose, by weaponry. So they have in them arrowheads, daggers, a mace and some jewellery that is jewellery that would belong to someone of esteem or somebody important in Bronze Age society. So this is a story that's going to be covered on TV. It's going to be in a new series called Silk Road and the Caucasus on Channel 4. But this is really saying maybe these are the Amazons. Look, one find does not a civilization make, but this does build on other similar finds. So there's been finds in Russia back in 2019. Again, it was a group of only women who looked like they had died in a battle-like scenario. And in both cases, there's some interesting features around the skeletal remains. So one is the joints in the fingers, which appear to be somewhat deformed. And what the archaeologists are saying is this is possibly from using a bow and arrow all the time, that they would see these kind of changes to joints in people who are using that kind of equipment all the time.
Right.
The other thing is the pelvis of these skeletons, you know, bear the hallmarks of being on horseback nearly all the time. And again, that's kind of the legend in this area around the stands and what would have been called Scythia in ancient Greece, Greek times, you know, that these women would have been on horseback. They would have been sort of like marauding gangs of fearsome warriors. So I suppose it's just these things that we're picking up in archaeology that reinforce that possibly this myth has some foundation in fact. And of course, it also chimes with local folklore in these areas. And you often do find that whole oral tradition that's passed down through even hundreds and hundreds of years, that it does, you know, hark back to real history that people remembered and passed on through generation and generation. So it's another find, which I suppose tells us maybe these Amazons were roaming the steppes.
The Amazon women were famous for being tall, were they not?
I think they were fearsome. They were sort of fearsome.
They weren't known as being super tall. Like, I'm just wondering, like, these skeletons, I presume they're all female, but they're not particularly tall.
No, they didn't. I mean, again, I think that sort of Amazonian warrior, it's more about the fearsome. And we've come to use that word now to maybe mean a woman that's very tall and strong. But again, some of these were girls as well. Some of the skeletons are only teenagers. So again, you know, and ranging into up to age 40 and 50, but no men. And of course, that was probably the key thing about Amazon society, that it was a man-free zone.
Mm.
And certainly so far, no men in these finds. Although having said that, perhaps if a man was in the find, we wouldn't link it in our minds to the Amazon.
Yeah,
wonders if there's a cause and effect there.
Aidan, our producer, has pointed out that idea of the Amazons being really tall comes from Futurama, which is not great for my mixing. Well, I suppose it is a myth. So there's two different types of myth. The modern myth of Futurama and the more ancient myth.
I think they would appreciate
both. Yeah, they absolutely can. Not the heaviest of science news this week, but you know what? That's actually okay every once in a while, because next week we'll probably have more climate change stuff to talk about. Dr. Shane Birkin from UCD and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland. Happy Easter and thanks for coming. There are enough nuclear warheads in the planet to destroy the Earth many times over, but It seems like a very unlikely scenario, but according to a new book, all it might take is one single rocket launch to kick everything off. The book is called Nuclear War: A Scenario. The author is investigative journalist Annie Jacobson. She writes on war and weapons, national security and secrets. We had a really interesting discussion with you a few years back that I still think back on about DARPA. We might dig that out for the podcast on Tuesday. But Annie, lovely to have you back on the program. Talk to us about the concept for this book, because it is a book of fiction grounded in fact. Or it's not, I suppose it's not really fiction, and it's not really just facts, right?
It is a non-fiction, fact-based scenario of what could happen in the event of a nuclear exchange. And it's sourced from scores of top-tier national security individuals that I have worked with over 10 years reporting on these issues.
Yeah, the book is front loaded with all of these very impressive sources. So when you're reading the book, as really terrifying as you write it, Annie, I mean, you really don't hold back. You have to remind yourself in a way because I was reading it kind of thinking this couldn't be the way it has been and the way it's going to be, can it? And then I'm reminded that this is a really well-researched book. So it's about a hypothetical scenario with a strike on the Pentagon and what might happen from the very moment that strike is announced. But before we go into that, because I do want to get into a bit of detail on that, where are we? Where? How do we get to the state where we're in? Because we used to have lots of nuclear warheads, I presume, Cold War and later. But it seems like that presumably is less. Where are we with nuclear arms at the moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're certainly at lower numbers than we used to be. At one point, there were 70,000 nuclear weapons ready to go. Now there are about 12,500. But if you back up for a minute, I think maybe the way to answer that question, which is why I wrote this book, I'm the author of 6 previous books that all deal with military and intelligence programs. So the CIA, the Pentagon, DARPA, as you said. And I've interviewed literally hundreds of these individuals who are at the forefront of these missions, whether they're paramilitary operators for the CIA or sitting beside the president as a national security advisor. And over the course of my interviewing, I cannot tell you how many of them said to me, I dedicated my life to preventing nuclear World War III, and I am proud, which got me thinking, what would happen if that no longer held as an idea? And I went back to many of these sources, and the first point of shock for me in this process of reporting this book was having them parrot my same concerns, right? So when you become an 80-year-old individual who is perhaps a previous U.S. Secretary of Defense, you begin to have thoughts about this. And that's what I found particularly astonishing. I was able to get the heart and soul fear of some of these individuals who've spent their life working to deter nuclear war, which speaks to that arsenal that you asked me about. This idea, all of not having nuclear World War III is predicated on an idea called deterrence. The public knows it as MAD, mutual assured destruction. That if we all have enough nuclear weapons pointed at one another, no one would be mad enough to launch.
So we're in this situation where we have the will in some people, the capability, certainly in some countries, to launch that first rocket. And in the book, you sort of segment the book into sections of post-launch. And it's really interesting because in the first 4 minutes, so much happens in the United States. So take us through a little bit of that, if you don't mind. I want to talk about deterrence a bit in a bit. But what happens once that missile is launched at the Pentagon?
Yes. And this is sort of a central to the book, this idea that all anyone knows or thinks or talks about nuclear war is, oh, it will never happen. It's unimaginable. Well, then you learn from my reporting. Oh, it's very imaginable if you're someone at the Pentagon who has been rehearsing precisely what I take you through second by second, minute by minute, because that is how it happens. It doesn't happen in days and weeks, as you learned in my book, right? The scenario I present is over at 72 minutes. That is shocking. In the first few seconds alone, the initial spark of an ICBM launch, that's an intercontinental ballistic missile, which carries a nuclear warhead in its nose cone, that is captured by the Defense Department's incredibly powerful satellite system called SBIRS, Space-Based Infrared System. Anyone wanting to nerd out on technology, read my footnotes. This Lockheed system in space, parked over North Korea, sees the launch in under 1 second. I mean, that alone is mind-blowing. When you think about that technology, and then there begins the next second. Then we could talk, you know, and again, I take the reader through it minute by minute, hopefully at a fast paced, the speed at which all of this unfolds, the information then goes from space down to these various command centers in the United States. How about the fact that the United States Command and Control has three underground bunkers that are working on this issue, this problem, this potential 24/7? 365 days a year. They're underneath the Pentagon. There's one underneath STRATCOM, Strategic Command in Nebraska. And there's an underground bunker that's famous and really does exist inside Cheyenne Mountain. And there begins this, what do we do next from the nuclear command and control? And as you learn in the book, it's just a few minutes before the president needs to be briefed about counterattack.
And this is what's so fascinating to me, because in America, and I'm not sure about the other countries, but in America, there's a launch on warning policy.
That's right.
Can you tell me what that means?
That's right. Right. And, you know, for any of the listeners out there who are just, that's not true. Let me just quote former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, who went on the record with me and said, Annie, we have a launch on warning policy. It's exactly like it sounds. Launch on warning. And he paraphrased for me that, in other words, when the United States learns that a nuclear missile is on the way, we do not wait to absorb the nuclear blow before we launch a counterattack. Perry said, we do not wait. That is policy, period. And so you can see the kind of insanity that begins within minutes. Yes, America does have what is called a secondary early warning system that will confirm what the satellites are saying. And that happens in about 8 or 9 minutes. The ground-based radar systems that are positioned around the world and in America that can see the ballistic missile as it comes over the horizon heading toward the United States. Once that secondary confirmation is made, the president gives the order to launch.
It's absolutely terrifying to me, because a launch on warning policy means you have, how long does it take for an intercontinental ballistic missile to reach the Pentagon from Moscow or from North Korea?
It's very precise. And this is also just shocking. 26 minutes and 40 seconds from a launch pad in Russia, 33 minutes from a launch pad in North Korea.
So before that time has hit, in other words, before that missile has landed, there's been detection, scrambling of fighter jets to see if there's anything they can do, briefing of security, briefing of president. And that president then has a launch on warning policy to retaliate immediately. But by the time 26 minutes or 35 minutes, whatever it is, we get to that point, will the president be sure where that missile has come from and that they're retaliating against the correct country?
Absolutely. Because of that SBIRS system developed by Lockheed, which can pinpoint precisely where that launch is from. right? So that is exactly why that counterattack policy is there. But even more bananas than the launch on warning, or perhaps equally bananas, is that we have what is called sole presidential authority. And that means that the president of the United States has the sole authority to launch nuclear weapons based on his own decision. He does not need to ask anyone, not the Secretary of Defense, not the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not anyone in Congress. This came up when former President Trump was in office. People were, people in the United States Congress were saying that's not accurate. Well, Congress did a report, released it. I source it in the book. This is absolutely inherent authority to the commander in chief. And you might say, in a democratic society, how is that even possible? Well, it is.
I mean, I understand that it can't be a democratic vote at that point in time. You don't have time to do that. But the idea that there is not two keys on that button is insane to me, particularly given the volatility of leaders internationally everywhere. So once this first missile is launched, the second one is launched before that even hit, back at the country that has attacked. I don't want to give too much of the book away because it is, again, when you read it, it's science fiction, and then you realize the author and the level of research that's gone in to verify what you're reading. It is a really, really interesting thought experiment. But does America launch 50 missiles back? Is it a aggressive response like we see in some conflicts in the West?
How does the counterattack, how is that decision made is what you're asking. And that's a very important one. So, and again, all sourced in the back. Whenever I have individuals talking in the book, it's either a quote from someone in the national security rubric that spoke to me, or it's got a source of where this information comes from. So, for example, during the Fire and Fury talks, STRATCOM Commander General Hyten answered that question for CNN, and he said very specifically, if North Korea needs to know, if they launch one, we launch one. If they launch two, we launch two. Okay, so there is that exists as one concept. However, if you look even deeper and you read the work of Bruce Blair, who was the world's leading expert on nuclear launch policy, not a spokesman for the Pentagon, but rather a former missileer who then worked for Princeton University's Center for Security that really tracked these things. Blair said that number is far more likely. They launch one, we launch 82 in retaliation.
What?
Because we need to take out, and he specifically identified the targets that the Defense Department would be going after in North Korea, because the concept behind that is called escalate to de-escalate, which is another Orwellian phrase and is an actual nomenclature from the Pentagon. Escalate to de-escalate. They launch one, we launch 82 to take out their ability to launch more weapons, which is, of course, a false premise, as you learn in the book.
So reading the book, Annie, I hope you don't mind me sharing my feelings on this. I was filled with a funny feeling towards the American military machine, because the SIOP, which you document in the book, and the decision-making that appears to bolster the nuclear defense policy of the United States seems to work towards, I won't say an apathy towards mass murder or mass death in any way, in however you want to frame it. For example, the SIOP looked at scenarios of the potential deaths of 600 million people. This mutually assured destruction scenario, as you mentioned, goes from one ballistic missile to literally the end of the world. It really did make me think, whoa, a little bit. I mean, what did you think hearing of these policies that talked about the deaths of hundreds of millions as scenarios that might work out depending on whatever the factors are?
Well, I had very similar feelings to you while I was reporting the book, which is exactly why I wrote it. So these nuclear war plans are among the most jealously guarded secrets in the U.S. government. And having the great fortune, as I did, to interview, for example, two former secretaries of defense, right? William Perry and Leon Panetta. These are men in their 80s and 90s who are Cold War warriors who, from my interviews with them, reveal to me that they too have these thoughts. Now that they look back on history, now that they have grandchildren, now that they wonder, who are the stewards of these nuclear war plans, these nuclear policies, these nuclear arsenals? And even perhaps with a tinge of hubris on their own part, shared with me that they felt, because they were there for the origin of this all, they perhaps somehow knew better. And I get the sense that as one gets close to the end of one's life, perhaps there's some real reflection on that. You referenced John Rubel and him talking about being privy to those plans. And I source that in the book. Rubel's confessions as an 80-year-old person in the early 2000s are astonishing in that regard. They're very rare. It's the only time that I could find that a defense official who was actually inside one of those meetings shared personally how he felt about it.
It's probably unfair to say this, but it's probably not miles off either. The Oppenheimer effect appears to be playing out in front of our eyes as we learn these extraordinary details of nuclear policy in America. We're speaking to Annie Jacobson. She's the author of a nonfiction book which details the hypothetical scenario of the launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile carrying nuclear warheads at the Pentagon and what would happen next, based in very rigorous research, in fact, and it is, as I've been saying, a real eye-opener. What about the genuine, credible threats? Because you talked about different personalities here and these elderly statesmen thinking back about the wards of these nuclear weapons. When we think of Russia and even America, how the story of war, of their country, is told is probably a little bit different to how it was told in the 60s and 70s, and it's probably more polarized and so on. Do you think that these officials are right to be worried about the consequences of hyping up America first, or Russia first, or North Korea first, and then handing over the keys to the nuclear weapons to that generation that you've not brainwashed, maybe, or maybe?
Absolutely.
Maybe brainwash is the right word?
Or perhaps instead of brainwash, just kept absolutely in the dark. Because if you keep somebody ignorant, they just simply can't know. And then they're going to take for granted, oh, mutual assured destruction. No one would ever launch nuclear weapons. That would be madness. One of the most interesting old timers, cold warriors that I interviewed for this book was Richard Garwin. Not a household name, but he should be. People think of Edward Teller when they think of the development of the thermonuclear bomb. It was actually Richard Garwin who drew the plans. Teller could conceive it theoretically, but he couldn't make it work. And this 24-year-old kid at Los Alamos named Richard Garwin drew it. It was a 10.4 megaton thermonuclear weapon exploded in 1952, proving that the super was possible. That's what it's called. It has an atomic bomb as its fuse. That's how powerful a thermonuclear weapon is. If you think about the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, Garwin's bomb was the equivalent of 1,000 of those bombs all going off at the same time from a single point. And it was Garwin who presented to me the idea of the possibility of a nuclear launch from North Korea. Poetically, he did this by telling me that the real big fear is now and always has been one madman with a nuclear weapon. Garwin called, he quoted Napoleon. He said, "Après moi le déluge." You know, this idea that, oh, after I'm gone, what does it matter? That's real madman thinking. And that is what I believe, and what many of my sources believe, we face right now in this present moment.
Is it dangerous, or is it extremely helpful to have the information that you reveal in this book made public, do you think?
I'm going to quote Former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, also the former director of the CIA, also the former White House Chief of Staff, whom I interviewed, I asked him that exact question. Secretary Panetta, could I be accused of fear-mongering and what would I say? And he said, Annie, the people should know.
The book is, I mean, I got it yesterday. I tore through it. It's called Nuclear War Scenario. The author is Annie Jacobson. Annie, an absolute pleasure to have you as always. The best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Aidan McKelvey joins me now to go through some of your comments from last week. Before we do that, though, holy crap. Did that just blow your mind, that interview?
Yeah, like I find myself kind of railing the optimist. We talked about you being a pessimist and being an optimist, whether or not that's true. But the optimist in me is railing against it. And the first thought I had, probably like a self-preservation thought, was there's a scene, there's a very famous scene in Doctor Strangelove where they're talking about the doomsday device. Yeah. And obviously Doctor Strangelove is a comedy and they're like, the Russian ambassador is explaining how the doomsday device will launch automatically and no matter what happens, there's no turning back. And the American guy is going like, but why didn't you tell anyone about it? It doesn't work if you don't tell anyone about it. And I had sort of the reverse thought of that, which hopefully was, well, they have to say that, don't they? That's part of the deterrence. I'm hoping, crossing my fingers and going, that automatic, whatever it was, 80 or so missiles, I'm hoping that that's, they're just saying that because that's part of the deterrence.
I mean, you would say that, but it's not a very well-known thing. And until Annie Jacobson had written this book, I had never heard that that was. I mean, what she talks about is literally the plot of Dr. Strangelove. I mean, it's mutually assured destruction. It seems absolutely insane to me that, and if you read the book, you know, she basically says there is not much wiggle room here. This must happen. This has to happen. This is the protocol. And this is what, you know, retired colonels who know what they're talking about have come on the record and said, because they're worried about what will happen when younger people who don't have the history or maybe don't have the context of the Cold War and perhaps, you know, are got their blood pumping from, you know, rhetoric from Trump or, you know, super pro-military guys maybe just don't understand how serious it is because they haven't seen, you know, enormous war of this scale. I mean, of course, you know, notwithstanding what's going on in Gaza and Syria and so on, but, and Ukraine, but like nuclear war, they just don't have any memory or any concept of it. So like, I think if it was one of those things where that's not really the case and they're just going to say that to make sure no one throws a missile at them, I'm not sure. And I also don't know about those deterrents stopping people. Like there's good psychology to show that, you know, certain deterrents work and certain deterrents don't. If I was a mad person, I had my hands on a nuclear missile and I was really pissed off the United States, which I'm sure there are plenty of those, minus the access to nuclear weapons, I probably would, you know, I'm not sure I would think about this as a major deterrent.
I definitely think the what happened with Russia in Ukraine, when that war started and how Putin talked about the war, that certainly kind of, war is obviously terrible, but one of the things from an outside of that region point of view that was very scary was it kind of gave the impression that Putin, it wasn't a very logical move what he did. Up until that point, you're thinking, okay, he's evil, but he's smart. But then it was so illogical to do it and such a mistake that it made you think, and the way he talked, his rhetoric around it was that maybe he doesn't give a shit. Maybe he's like, well, I'm going to be dead in a few months anyway. What difference does it make if I take everyone with me? And like, that's the terrifying bit. The bit like, deterrence makes sense in that you're like, well, I don't want to wipe out myself and all my family. Unless you're totally mad. And if you're totally mad and your worldview is totally egocentric, then you might just go, well, you know, I get to have the final say here because, like, I'm a fairly old man. I was going to die anyway.
Yeah.
That bit is, like, really scary. Just to offer one other sliver of hope, I think it is important to have a little bit of hope on this. There have been a number of incidences during the Cold War where a similar set of circumstance was in place.
Yeah.
And I guess good humans or, like, humane thought did prevail. There's Vasily Arkhipov, he was in the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the pressure was on him to launch and he just decided no. There was also a case in...
submarine.
Yeah, that was in the submarine. There was also a case in where a Russian military base got the incorrect readings about missiles coming their way. And the, very interestingly, the person in charge who saw the reading decided, well, what's the point? Like, yeah, we're going to die, but there's no point in killing all them as well. And he just didn't launch. Now, it turned out it was obviously a mistake. It hadn't been.
Yeah.
So look, there is that, but, you know, it's
like, no. And that, I, you know, you hope that the human in the machine is going to provide some sort of emotionally intelligent stopgap here. But, you know, protocol doesn't allow for that. So, you know, looking at what happens to people who don't follow orders in the States, you know, you can only count on that happening a few times. Yeah. I don't read a huge amount of nonfiction because of the work that I do in Future Proof, because I read a lot of sort of nonfiction stuff anyway. So for downtime, I don't really read a lot of nonfiction. This is a book I'm going to read from cover to cover. Okay. Let's have a look at some of your comments from last week. And we were talking with Jen Gunter about menstruation last week. And we got a text in. That is the weirdest guy ever. Talking about science on the radio and never knew what menopause is. Working in a school, every child I knew what it was at age 10. I mean, I actually was talking about what actually happened with menstruation more than menopause. But like at age 10, they knew that menstruation was the shedding of the lining of the uterus. I don't think that's true. I knew that women and girls bled, and it was something to do with the fact that they were coming of age. That's all I knew, really. And to be honest, I mean, I'm 48, so there really wasn't a lot talked about in school. And the other thing is, I've said this a few times over the years, you know, kind of pointing out that someone doesn't know something, like, and I can't believe they didn't know that. I kind of feel like, you know, there's loads of things that you don't know that I don't know and vice versa. I think making people feel stupid because they don't know the answer to something and I've asked a question about it, I think that's a, you know, personally, I know I'm the target here, but I don't like it when I hear other people say it about other people.
Yeah, no, it's true. And actually, in defense of you, I have largely the same experience. Now, maybe this person's talking about kids now, and I hope he is. That's good if the kids now or kids in the last few years get taught this. But like the teaching on sex in general I'm 41, so it still persisted after your time in school. Teaching on sex in general was so kind of vague and sometimes like worryingly leaning towards sort of a non-biological explanation, let's put it that way. And I definitely was in like secondary school. I don't think I really had a proper clue about menstruation at all until like I had my first girlfriend. And then it was like embarrassing to be going like, what? This is what you're doing? Every month. Now, obviously, I knew the thing was, there was blood and there was shedding of the uterus. But I mean, I just didn't know all the stuff around it and how kind of pervasive it is an experience and how kind of it dictates things for women. Like, I didn't know any of that. It was totally new to me because you don't really get taught that. You get maybe as a boy, certainly if you're in a boys' primary school, which I was when I, thankfully, I was in a mixed secondary school, but in the primary school, it was just like one line. Oh, yeah, this happens once a month. Done.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's what I knew at the time. And that's just the way it was. We also got a text in. We were talking to Philip Smith, our news round contributor, about a story where someone was proposing that snake meat is a new source of our proteins because we can't be farming animals and snakes turn their food into protein very quickly. And I said, this is just not going to work. I mean, this is just one of those things where someone who's into snakes just says something because he hopes that people appreciate snakes more. But I just don't see us farming snakes and eating snakes in the future to solve our diet problems. I just don't see it happening. And Lousy, or maybe Lousy is the comment at the end. Yeah. Maybe that's not their name, but it could be. Says, why would you get a guest on to talk about a subject and then rubbish it? Very awkward. Well, actually, we do that all the time on the shows. This might have been your first time listening, but we rubbish stories that make it into the press all the time if we feel they're overreaching or over-exaggerating or if they're underpowered studies or if there's a huge amount of bias or they didn't ask a key question. I think that's a really important part of our show, that we often look at the science that's in the news, in the papers, and say, okay, what is it, you know, what does it mean when the Daily Mail says, you know, 5 cups a day, you know, increases your chance of colorectal cancer by 50%? You know, it's important for us to kind of look beyond the face value of headlines and say, okay, realistically, in the real world, will this extremely expensive, a very complicated approach to curing a cancer make it to the shelves of hospitals? And the answer sometimes, you know, is important to look for.
It's like a journalistic peer review.
Yeah, I mean, that's a haughty way of putting it. I like to say
that puts that us
we just call bullshit on stories. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, same sides of the different sides of the same coin. That's it from us. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey and the rest of the team here on Future Proof. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. But on Thursday, we will release that DARPA episode where we spoke to Annie Jacobson about the defense research arm of the US military. Fascinating interview. If you liked what you just heard, you'll love that. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.